companions. This is Joyce, your Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading some more information from Bob Tart's book, Kitty Cornered, How Franny and Five Other Incorrigible Cats Seized Control of Our House and Made It Their Home. And if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles and newsletters about the animals in our lives. We're going to start today's readings with Kitty Cornered by Bob Tart. In the last reading, we learned that Bob was telling us about his colleague who was moving away and needed to find a home for his cat, Lucy. He said that Lucy was fat and very lovable, and today we'll find out whether or not that was true. The next morning, I raced Moby to the bathroom. Despite her advanced age, she easily outpaced me. I found her up on the toilet waiting for her water dish. We had started referring to Moby as I want, due to her constant demands for one thing or another. And if the one thing wasn't water, another was. Had she been genuinely thirsty 24 hours a day, we might have been concerned, but she was less interested in lapping up her water than in having me serve her by holding her bowl. I stood beside her like a sommelier with the dish for her to sample. She dipped a tentative tongue into the front, evaluated the liquid with fussiness of a wine expert, then leaned forward to harvest the superior ambrosia in the back of the bowl. "I can't go into work today," I told Linda, as I held the bowl steady. "Not after last night." I had started holding Mooby's water dish to try to discourage the aging cat from jumping up to the bathroom vanity. I didn't want her to break a leg at the dismount. Despite her arthritis, she still managed the occasional gazelle leap without mishap, but her surest vaults were long behind her. I would discover some months later that this practice was even more dangerous than I had imagined. "That wasn't anything," Linda said from the bed. "Just tell them what happened." I never heard the end of it. "I'll walk out into the warehouse and Randy will say, 'Find your way up here, all right? I can probably find you a GPS to borrow.' If I stay home, everyone will think I was sick." When Mooby wasn't obsessed with water, she was begging for canned cat food. Sometimes she couldn't make up her mind which of the two she preferred. Intercepting me in the hallway, she might veer to the right into the bathroom, or she might swerve to the left into the dining room and onto another decision fork. She could plant herself in front of the refrigerator, angling for a treat, or she could amble toward the side door to go outside, eat grass, and, of course, throw up. What if someone asks why you weren't there? I hadn't thought of things out that far. I guess I'll make something up. You can't do that. It wouldn't be right. Well, maybe I can say I had a nosebleed that lasted all night long. Linda's silence indicated her disapproval. Suddenly bored with the water bowl, Mooby headed for the refrigerator, intent upon back-to-back treats. I followed, but she turned on her kitty heels, trotted back into the bathroom, and requested another session with the water bowl. I wondered how she could turn such modest pleasures into the high points of her day. But I hadn't yet met Lucy, who would flourish without a single overjoy in her life, although biting us probably came close. I straggled into work, bracing myself for the inevitable peppering of questions and keeping the nosebleed excuse tucked in the front of my brain. But to my immense relief, nobody mentioned the party. Everyone was too busy with a Christmas rush, so I hadn't had time to make anything up. Shortly before dinner, Dave arrived at our house with Lucy in an undersized pet carrier that exaggerated her enormousness. As Lucy's massive face peered at me through the gate, I felt like Jack after having climbed the beanstalk. Surely the first time she stood up straight, she would uproot our house and carry it around on her back. The illusion of monumental proportions lessened once Dave ejected her from the carrier. She nervously snipped our sectional couch, but it returned when he pulled her food dish from a plastic bag. The purple dish was far too tiny even for our dwarf rabbit, Rudy, and it probably would have starved our parakeets. I wondered how she had attained her ample girth as I pictured her wedging her tongue into the bowl to extract the single kibble that would fill it to the brim. While I crouched down to let Lucy sniff my hand, Dave reached into the bag a second time. He whisked out a litter box that was approximately one-third the length of his cat. I briefly considered using it as her food dish, since it appeared brand spanking new. Well, weeks later, I would learn from Dave that Lucy never used this or any other pet store litter box. By that time, I'd learned from personal experience that Lucy and basic toilet hygiene did not coexist. "She's got a brush, too," he told me, and I strained my eyes as he extracted the microscopic object from his jacket pocket. "Brush her a few times and she'll be your friend for life." "Do you do it one hair at a time?" I asked. "Oh, she loves being brushed, don't you, Lucy?" She looked glum as he poked a flap of fat that hung down from her stomach. I vowed that I'd never tease her and earn that grim expression, squinty eyes, flattened ears, and puffed up cheeks. But this turned out to be her usual face. Despite the initial unfriendliness you would expect from any new cat, she seemed promising as a companion from the standpoint of sheer bulk. We needed a big, fat, huggable cat. Once upon a time, Mubi had filled the bill, but she had shrunken with age, turning from a walking ottoman into a tottering doll pillow. I thought about giving Lucy a welcoming squeeze, then changed my mind when she tried to wriggle back into her cat carrier. I wasn't sure I could have gotten my arms all the way around her anyway. Affecting a hunched-down armadillo posture, she scuttled upstairs. I found her under the bed, her camouflaging earth tones betrayed by a sudden stare. Back downstairs, I told Dave, "I don't think she likes it here." He lit up in a laugh. "She hid for 2 weeks when we first got her. It's hard for a cat to get used to a new environment." He laughed again. "She's just being Lucy." "Did you go to the Christmas party?" I asked. "Hell no. I hate those things. I'm assuming you didn't go." "No, no." I waved my hand. Mubi stood at the bottom of the stairs, gazing up as if contemplating an ascent, but she turned around and ambled back into our bedroom, where visitor-shy Agnes was probably lurking. "Not to change the subject," I said, "but did you ever have a nosebleed that lasted all night long?" "Not last night. Last night I had to rush Christy to the emergency room because she forgot to take her potassium again. She couldn't unclench her hands." He balled up his fists and grimaced like a boxer. "They stuck an IV in her and made her breathe into a bag. That's why I wasn't at work today. We were up most of the night. It's the second time this has happened in 2 months." And it actually happened? Boy, it sure did. Now that was an excuse, I thought. As Dave was leaving, I paused at the bottom of the stairs and listened for the sign of activity from on high. "If things don't work out with Lucy," I said, "and she doesn't get along with our other cats, or she never comes from under the bed, we may have to give her back to you." Dave nodded. "Oh, sure." But he knew as well as I did that we were stuck with Lucy now. My job was more harried than usual the next day as I churned out a last-minute Christmas sale newsletter. I managed to finish and fling myself out the door before the clock finished striking noon. Back home, Mubi stared at me from the welcome mat as if she'd been there the entire morning. Before she could steer me into the bathroom or the kitchen, I sidestepped her and headed for Linda's study. She was seated on an orthopedic cushion, paging through one of the several knick-knack catalogs scattered across her desk. "Do you think Jack would like this frog that croaks at you when you walk past it?" "I'm sure he would. My brother-in-law loved things like that." "You don't think it's stupid, do you? I never know what to buy anybody." I went upstairs to check on Lucy, who remained under the bed until I filled her bowl for the second time that morning. When she finally straggled downstairs shortly before dinner, Mubi took a wide detour into the bedroom closet, while Agnes made a snarling feint in her general direction before retreating to the basement. I searched for a way to approach the subject gently. "Have you been petting her?" I asked Linda. "When I bent down to rub her ears a little while ago, well, it seemed like she kind of nipped me, but I might have just bumped my hand on one of those bed springs." "We must have been misreading the situation. Lucy was simply suffering from a bout of unease in an unfamiliar house. Surely a cat that we had saved from the animal shelter, especially a cat that Dave had described as very affectionate, couldn't wait to shower us with gratitude." I told myself that it would be just a couple of more days until Lucy's love for her new owners started to flow. Chapter 3. Dinner was even more harried than usual. Bella decided to squawk instead of eating. Dusty methodically transferred his veggies into the water bowl, and I had to dash outside to figure out what was upsetting the geese. After we finally covered the cages for the night, I assumed that the drama had ended, but a theatrical sigh from Linda indicated otherwise. "What's this?" she asked, bending down near the litter box. She touched her finger to a circle of liquid on the linoleum, raised the finger to her nose, and grimaced. "With which ungrateful cat peed on the floor again?" she asked Lucy. "I bought the biggest litter box I could find this time. You'll have to get her a bigger one." "They don't make them any bigger," I said. "It's for pet bison. It holds 300 pounds of litter. That ought to be big enough." Lucy had long ago gotten over her initial uneasiness to disperse her bad disposition throughout our house. In the beginning, she disturbed her impressive bulk across the floor, smack dab in the middle of the highest traffic spots she could find, forcing humans, animals, and cross-country buses into a wide detour. After Christmas, she transferred the load to the dining room chair near the front door. Taking over this humble seat of oak, she turned it into her throne. No one could pass without being subjected to her withering judgment and the frequent slap of a front paw. "We're talking about you, Lucy Caboosey," I said. She was awake in what passed as a good mood when I approached her chair. She rolled onto her side, curling her paws demurely and letting her eyelids sag in a seductive invitation to pet the lovely kitty's chest. I grabbed a hind foot instead, rolling her completely over on her back, where she balanced like a beetle that had tumbled off a downspout. She held completely still in that position, purring with half-open mouth, ecstatic that I had eased her into her favorite posture for striking out her fangs. "Why do you want to fight with people who love you?" The trick was letting go of her foot and jerking away my hand before the snap of her alligator jaws caught me. I won for once, though I counted my fingers to make sure. She hadn't turned out to be the bright addition to our household that I had expected. She reminded me of the Yakety Yob toy robot that I had begged my parents to buy me for Christmas when I was a child. By sticking an arm into Yakety's back and working the levers, you could make his eyes roll, arms open and close, and mouth move. I figured he would add much-needed color to the anemic personality, but I enjoyed my sky-blue plastic companion for barely a week. "You got what?" Alan Jaglowski asked me during fourth grade recess. "That's for babies. Tart plays with babies." For the next several months, Yakety Yob gathered dust on my bedroom shelf as a nagging reminder of my bad judgment. My mother would catch me staring glumly into space in my rehearsal for adult depression. "If you're bored, why don't you play with Yob, your doll you wanted so much," she'd say. Linda's growing disappointment with Lucy was not only prickling my gut over having lobbied for the cat, but it also poked this ancient psychological boil. She thinks that as long as she stands in the litter box, she's using the litter box. She backs up all the way with her rear end hanging out into space. Do you suppose she's doing it on purpose? "I don't know," I said. "I don't know how she thinks." If she was missing her litter on purpose and there wasn't a medical reason behind the behavior, it could mean she was unhappy about her living situation. On the whole, she seemed as content as any cat that slept 22 hours a day. But during her waking moments, she had never approached either of us with anything resembling affection, and that struck me as cold. "You're not paying the rent," I told Lucy, wagging a finger at her face from a safe distance. Paying the rent was how our cats justified staying beneath our roof. Agnes paid the rent with the currency of cuteness. Occasionally she'd toss us the gratuity of letting us pet her and by tagging along when we took long walks down to the river. She also snagged the occasional basement mouse. Mooby paid her rent by dint of having one green eye and one blue eye, which I found alternately charming and disquieting. She socked away pillowcases full of rent credit by snoozing next to me, waking from a sound sleep and switching on the purr machine, and by showering us with the coinage of her sweet personality. Although Lucy's large, round face verged on pretty, she rewarded my praise with a sucking-on-a-lemon look. In her favor, she had come to us with a pretty pink collar, and as far as I knew, her fangs didn't carry venom. But the list of negatives was longer. She wasn't nice. She'd stolen a chair. She didn't like us or our cats. She barely tolerated the touch of a hand unless her teeth got the act. And she loved the Tom DeLay episodes of Dancing with the Stars. In short, she was a cat who didn't even come close to paying the rent, and her litter box messes had put her even more in arrears. I'll call Dave tomorrow afternoon and see if he had the same problem with her. And make him take her back. Okay, I said half-heartedly, but I had already made a promise to myself. I would do everything within my power to make Lucy like me. And if I couldn't get her to like me, I would do the next best thing. I'd outsmart her in the litter box department. Dave no longer sat across from me each morning at work. I would have been surprised if he had, since he had taken a new job on the other end of town, a more interesting position that paid better. He claimed, but I knew this was an excuse. The real reason he had quit his job was because he couldn't bear to face me after inflicting a fat, nippy nuisance of a cat on us. She's doing great. Everything's just fine, I told him on the phone in a voice dripping with sarcasm. I had just finished wiping the floor behind Lucy's box before Linda could discover the latest mishap. We don't even mind that she bites us at every possible opportunity. She can be a real queen bitch, that's for sure, he said, laughing. And I assumed that the term queen bitch was a euphemism for very affectionate. I described Lucy's toilet troubles. Oh, he said, we didn't use the litter box I bought you. We used a big plastic box that our Christmas wrapping paper came in. Even then, she overshot it. It didn't matter much since her box was in the basement. Reasonable people like Dave would hide a litter box in the cellar or tuck it into a corner of a bathroom, but Mooby was too arthritic to trek down a flight of stairs, and we reserved the only open corner of our bathroom for our feet. So by default, I placed the box on the open corridor that ran along one side of the living room. On the other side of the room, where carpet and less sound judgment lay, we put a second litter box for the rabbits on top of an array of plastic carpet runners. At least Lucy had stayed away from the bunny box so far. Any chance your dad still might take her? When Dave answered no, I experienced a twitch of relief. If we got rid of Lucy before I could get her to like me, I would feel like I had failed. And to some degree, I might even miss her, which seemed to speak well for the cat. On the other hand, I had suffered a pang of regret after sweeping Yakety Yob off my bedroom shelf and cramming him into a drawer. That feeling had quickly passed. What did he say? Linda asked after I hung up. He misses Lucy. He wants to stop by sometime just to hang out with her. Good grief. I couldn't imagine what hanging out with Lucy would entail unless it involved a bandage and a mop. Dave obviously appreciated a side to her that I hadn't yet seen. The planetary sphere of a cat lay on her back with her legs sticking straight up into the air, ready to box or even bite while fast asleep. I thought if the continent of crabbiness possessed a temperate region, it would definitely take a team of explorers to find it. Next week, we'll continue reading Kitty Cornered by Bob Tart, how Franny and five other incorrigible cats seized control of our house and made it their home. Our next reading comes from Best Friends, the November-December 2025 edition. Best Friends is the magazine for the Best Friends Animal Sanctuary in Kanab, Utah. This article, Random Acts of Kindness. Kindness is powerful, and even the smallest act to help an animal, the planet, or another person plants a seed for more good to come. That's why Best Friend's vision is a better world through kindness to animals. Everyday animal lovers are making a difference through their actions, and we're excited to share a few of these stories right here. Cutest Commuter. Betsadita Mercado was on the New York City subway when a particularly petite passenger patted her way on board, causing a commotion. Betsaida looked up to see what was happening, but she needed to look down instead. It was a kitten who'd captured everyone's attention. When it became clear the kitten was alone, unaccompanied by a human, Betsaida took responsibility for the tiny tabby. Her first thought was making sure that the kitten was okay. Her second, realizing she was going to be a cat mom. She named the kitten Emmy, short for MTA, Metropolitan Transportation Authority, and took her to the vet, where she got a clean bill of health. At home now with Betsaida, Emmy is enjoying a different mode of transportation, seeing the sights of her city tucked safely in her pet stroller. Sweetness after the storm. In the aftermath of the floods that devastated Texas Hill Country, 11-year-old Cameron wanted to channel her heartbreak into helping. She decided to sell homemade cookies and donate the proceeds to Kerrville Pets Alive and Texas A&M University Veterinary Emergency Team to help animals impacted by the flood. And baked she did. A family friend who's a baker let Cameron use her commercial kitchen and local businesses and offered Cameron spots to set up her cookie stand. So far, Cameron has made and sold over 1,000 cookies, raising thousands of dollars for flood relief efforts to help pets and their people. Priority Pup. When mail carrier Ian Burke adopted Floyd from a Texas animal shelter, the pair already shared a meaningful history. Ian had delivered mail to Floyd's person for years and always enjoyed his visits with the man and his big, happy-go-lucky pup. But when Ian's route changed, they lost touch until a coworker let Ian know that Floyd's person had passed away and Floyd had ended up in the local shelter. Ian's route was crystal clear. He knew how cherished Floyd had been in his former home, and he wanted to continue that love by making Floyd a part of his family. As Ian says, it's one of the best things he's received through the mail. Enchanted Encounters. Sitting all alone at the dog park, Archie must have been so confused. Thankfully, Jeff Chatton was out that evening in his Arkansas neighborhood, and he spotted the small, speckly pup with velvety black ears. No one claimed him, so Jeff decided to take him in, temporarily. But with travel plans looming, he knew he needed to get some help. He asked around in the community and met Kevin Gerkins, who immediately fell head over heels for Archie and decided to bring him home as a new family member. But the fairy tale magic didn't stop there. Jeff and Kevin became fast friends after realizing they had a lot in common. They were both Texas transplants and former bicycle racers who share mutual friends. And the happily ever after? Kevin has fulfilled his dream to open his own restaurant named Archie's Sandwichery. And Legacy of Love. The grief that follows losing a pet is deep, but remembering our best friends and connecting with others who've experienced pet loss can help to turn that sadness into a legacy of love. That's why Lynn Bird of North Carolina created Little Pet Chapels. Lynn and her husband build chapels, small wooden structures with beautiful designs and doors that open to an interior space, and have a contract to install them in local parks and other public spaces. Passersby can leave little notes to memorialize their pets inside each chapel. The chapels become covered in a patchwork of words, drawings, photos, and more that honor beloved pets. It's Lynn's way to show people who are grieving that they're not alone and to amplify awareness of the human-animal bond. Legacy of love. Twinning is winning. What are the odds? Two dogs with nearly identical names, matching coats, and personalities that clicked instantly. Didgery and Didgeridoo weren't born together, and they didn't arrive at the sanctuary at the same time. But from the moment they met, it felt like they'd always been part of the same pack. Didgery came to the sanctuary shy and withdrawn, unsure about people and new experiences. Didgeridoo arrived a few months later, needing surgery for a tendon injury after returning from several years in a home. She not only had nearly the same name as Didgery, but the two dogs looked remarkably alike. Caregiver Landon Schobert brought Didgery home as a foster pet, where she slowly settled into a life in a home, but still mostly kept to herself. Then when Didgeridoo needed a place to recover from surgery, Landon fostered her too, and that's when everything changed. We hadn't seen Didgeridoo play with other dogs, Landon said. But the moment she met Didgeridoo, she was playboying, rolling in the grass, showing completely her enthusiasm, and her whole life seemed to light up. These days, Didgeridoo flops on the couch for belly rubs, follows Didgeridoo everywhere, and looks to her friend for cues before diving into new experiences. And when Didgeridoo was recovering from surgery, Didgeridoo stayed close, offering quiet companionship. It's been so sweet watching them blossom in their own ways, Landon said. Didgeridoo, or Dewey as I call her, loves having her companionship, and seeing Didgeridoo become a more confident dog with Dewey by her side is incredible. For both dogs, twinning really is winning, especially when your twin is your bestie. All these articles come from the magazine Best Friends, the November-December 2025 issue. The slogan, "Together we can save them all," is the slogan and the magazine for Best Friends Animal Sanctuary in Kanab, Utah. Well, that brings us to the conclusion of today's show. I hope you enjoyed the readings, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.